Jack McCallum has joined us on Sports Byline USA. Again, I want you to check out this book because it's a wonderful read. It's called Dream Team, How Michael, Magic, Larry, Charles, and the Greatest Team of All Time Conquered the World and Changed the Game of Basketball Forever. I know that both Larry and Michael Jordan both like to have challenges during the course of their career, a lot like Muhammad Ali. He had to have some type of controversy around him or even created it in order to bring his best game out. Did they both do that during the course, and particularly Michael, during the course of the Olympics?
Well, they had a legend, particularly Michael, you're right. I mean, they had a legendary scrimmage game in Monte Carlo when the team was really going to go. You know, Chuck Daly felt that they needed to mix it up a little bit before the Olympics, and the way it evolved this day was that he had happened to put Magic and Michael on different teams. Stockton was hurt and Clyde Drexler was hurt, and that left, you know, not enough guards, and so Michael ended up guarding Magic Johnson. You know, I got a hold of this tape from the scrimmage game and listened to it. You know, I've listened to it 100 times, and the greatest thing about it is the private trash talking, well, not private, it was public in the gym, between Michael and Magic, you know, and Magic's team got far ahead, and he started talking a little bit too much. And Michael came back, and his team in the end won, and really it was, you know, it never devolved into fist fight, but there were some tense moments, and Mike Krzyzewski always remembers this as the best example of this guy's. They were in a closed gym. There's no reporters, there's no applause, there's no cameras, there's no nothing except the satisfaction of beating the guy on the other team. And Krzyzewski always remarks that game was played as hard as any game he ever saw, and it was really only for pride. And that defined who those guys were.
Yeah, that's what Coach K told me as well. I want to ask you about the Clyde Drexler story. Clyde, of course, the 11th man named to that team. And there's some, you know, I know what Magic has said, and I also know what Clyde has said about the relationship between the two and whether he disparaged Magic or not. Set that scene for me, if you will, Jack.
Well, and you know, I went to see Clyde and interviewed every one of the 12 guys, and I, you know, Clyde, I think, likes to present the idea that he wasn't miffed at being named late to the team. They named 10 guys, and then they had kind of a season-long quote, audition, and, you know, they named Clyde, and they added the one college player, Christian Laettner, and Clyde, rightfully so, you know, in my opinion, was added on, and, you know, he never wanted to let it to be known that he was mad about it, but I think years later that he is, and I think it comes out once in a while, but what happened was they took an excerpt from the book on a website, Deadspin, and sort of presented the quotes, which are accurate, but the lead into it kind of indicated that the Dream Team was sitting around waiting for Magic to die, and the Dream Team pitied Magic, and that we didn't want him there. That was not the way it came down at all. Clyde was talking about a feeling that was in the league, around the league in general, that people were kind of taking it easy on Magic. So, you know, I certainly do not fabricate quotes, but I did see, I hope it's a little bit straighter in the book. I don't think that Clyde's going to be entirely happy with when it comes out, but I don't think it's going to come out as harshly as it was presented in the excerpt.
Yeah, the quote is, Johnson couldn't guard his shadow and that everyone kept waiting for Magic to die. Every time he'd run up the court, everybody would feel sorry for the guy and he'd get all that benefit of the doubt. And it's pretty strong words, but I think you're right. Neither one are probably going to be particularly happy. I was over in Barcelona when they played over there. There was some jealousy among the Olympians because these guys were rock stars. They didn't stay in the Olympic Village. They had their own hotel and everything. Tell me what it was like over there being around that team and the whole atmosphere.
Well, by the time they got to Barcelona, they had already practiced in San Diego, and they had already been together in Portland and played kind of an international field there, as you remarked. But so we should have been, as you know, experienced reporters, we should have been kind of prepared for the, you know, what this was going to be in Barcelona. And incredibly, it was even more extreme than we thought. I remember going over there the first night and thinking, well, I'll stop in the hotel. You know, maybe I'll have a beer with Barkley or find a couple of the public relations guys or Chuck Daly, maybe if he's not busy. I couldn't get within three blocks of the hotel. There were thousands of people simply staring at the hotel as if somehow, you know, Michael Jordan was going to come out on the balcony and do a dance or something. It was extraordinary. And the amazing thing in retrospect was that the attention continued. That you get it maybe the first night, you get it the second night. On day 17, when they went for the gold medal against Croatia, the attention given to that team was absolutely as much as it was in the beginning of the games. And that was a change that the U.S. Olympic Committee, that was something they simply had not only had not anticipated, but were not used to in any way, shape, or form. And there was some resentment about these guys, no doubt about it.
Was there much of an awe factor from the teams that played against the U.S. squad there?
Well, unless you consider the fact that when the United States team came out, the other team stopped practicing and picked up cameras, that's pretty much a hint that perhaps you have that game won. The first time it happened in Portland, it sounds like the kind of thing that you should say, gee, they should have had more dignity, they should try to beat them. But you know what? In retrospect, I find it a really irresistible part of this lore that at that point in time, these guys had the opportunity to play against the greatest players in the world. And 20 years later, there's a picture on about 25 guys' mantles, and they're showing their grandkids or they're showing their nephew, and they're saying, hey, look, that's me, that's your uncle, that's Michael Jordan. I played against that guy, and I find that really satisfying.
Yeah, here he is slamming over your uncle.
Exactly, yeah.
Scottie Pippen says that the refs gave Jordan breaks, but that was no different than what he got in the NBA, though, wasn't it, Jack?
Well, Scottie was actually talking about the breaks that Michael got during the year. I mean, he was talking about being his teammate, and Scottie was saying it was, you know, it was a two-edged sword. I mean, it was very hard to figure out how to play with Michael. He was the greatest star in the world when Scottie first got there, that he didn't. You know, Michael didn't really trust his teammates. There were some chemistry problems that were straightened out when Phil Jackson came. But the flip side of that is that Michael was so great. I mean, Scottie describes going out for the opening tip, and the referees are asking Scottie if he can get Michael sneakers after the game. So how objectively, honestly, are you going to call that game? It's going to be very difficult to repress your natural impulses toward idolizing that player.
When you have a chance now, and Jack, it's some years later after that 1992 Olympics in Barcelona, what were the after effects of that U.S. dream team in that Olympics?
Well, I think they kind of were twofold, and they went in opposite directions as far as our game went. It's hard to draw the exact parallel, but our game, the NBA, you know, the way it was perceived domestically, went kind of down. I mean, Larry walked away from the game. Magic was semi-forced into retirement by HIV. Michael left the game for a season and a half. The other guys stayed on, but Patrick Ewing was, you know, kind of near the end of his career. And there was sort of that kind of marked like the end of this golden era in basketball. And a lot of the guys that came in afterward just sort of wanted those same things the Dream Team had without paying the price that they paid for them. I mean, I've always, my line about Jordan is the most unbelievable thing about him was that he exceeded his hype, that he got all the hype in the world, but he was as good at it. He deserved it. And I think the class that came in after him always didn't, they wanted some of the rewards without paying some of the price. And what happened overseas was that because of the example of the Dream Team and the way, you know, coaching spread and people started coming to the game instead of the best athletes in Spain, suddenly now they're playing basketball instead of soccer, that the world improved much, much quicker than we did. And so we did a lot to improve the product overseas, but probably we didn't do anything to improve the product in our own country.
We've got about 15 seconds left, but what do you want people to take away from the book, Jack?
I think probably that at a moment in time, these guys came together. I'm not suggesting they deserve the Medal of Honor or anything like it, but they came together. They didn't do it for money. They suppressed their egos. They had one goal in mind, and they were able to come together and give any basketball fan or Olympic fan one of the greatest collection of memories in the history of our sporting culture.
Well, congratulations on the book, Jack. Thanks for joining us. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
Jack McCallum, Dream Team is the name of the book. We continue on Sports Byline.